After a while, he realized that he was thinking of his past, as if certain days of it were spread before him, demanding to be seen again. He did not want to look at them. He despised memories as a pointless indulgence. But then he understood that he thought of them tonight in honor of that piece of metal in his pocket. Then he permitted himself to look. He saw the day when he stood on a rocky ledge and felt a thread of sweat running from his temple down his neck. He was 14 years old, and it was his first day of work in the iron mines of Minnesota. He was trying to learn to breathe against the scalding pain in his chest. He stood cursing himself, because he had made up his mind that he would not be tired. After a while, he went back to his task. He decided that pain was not a valid reason for stopping. He saw the day when he stood at the window of his office and looked at the mines. He owned them as of that morning. He was 30 years old. What had gone on in the years between did not matter, just as pain had not mattered. He had worked in mines and foundries, in the steel mills of the North, moving toward the purpose he had chosen. All he remembered of those jobs was that the men around him had never seemed to know what to do, while he had always known. He remembered wondering why so many iron mines were closing, just as these had been about to close until he took them over. He looked at the shelves of rock in the distance. Workers were putting up a new sign above a gate at the end of a road. Reardon Ore. He saw an evening when he sat slumped across his desk in that office. It was late and his staff had left, so he could lie there alone unwitnessed. He was tired. It was as if he had run a race against his own body, and all the exhaustion of years which he had refused to acknowledge had caught him at once and flattened him against the desktop. He felt nothing except the desire not to move. He did not have the strength to feel, not even to suffer. He had burned everything there was to burn within him. He had scattered so many sparks to start so many things, and he wondered whether someone could give him now the spark he needed, now when he felt unable ever to rise again. He asked himself who had started him and kept him going. Then he raised his head. Slowly, with the greatest effort of his life, he made his body rise until he was able to sit upright with only one hand pressed to the desk and a trembling arm to support him. He never asked that question again. He saw the day when he stood on a hill and looked at a grimy wasteland of structures that had been a steel plant. It was closed and given up. He had bought it the night before. There was a strong wind, and a gray light squeezed from among the clouds. In that light he saw the brown red of rust, like dead blood on the steel of the giant cranes, and bright green living weeds, like gorged cannibals growing over piles of broken glass at the foot of walls made of empty frames. At a gate in the distance he saw the black silhouettes of men. They were the unemployed from the rotting hovels of what had once been a prosperous town. They stood silently, looking at the glittering car he had left at the gate of the mills. They wondered whether the man on the hill was the Hank Reardon that people were talking about, and whether it was true that the mills were to be reopened. "The historical cycle of steelmaking in Pennsylvania is obviously running down," a newspaper had said, "and experts agree that Henry Reardon's venture into steel is hopeless. You may soon witness the sensational end of the sensational Henry Reardon." That was 10 years ago. Tonight the cold wind on his face felt like the wind of that day. He turned to look back. The red glow of the mills breathed in the sky, a sight as life-giving as a sunrise. These had been his stops, the stations which an express had reached and passed. He remembered nothing distinct of the years between them. The years were blurred, like a streak of speed. Whatever it was, he thought, whatever the strain and the agony, they were worth it, because they had made him reach this day. This day when the first heat of the first order of Reardon metal had been poured to become rails for Taggart Transcontinental. He touched the bracelet in his pocket. He had had it made from that first poured metal. It was for his wife. As he touched it, he realized suddenly that he had thought of an abstraction called his wife, not of the woman to whom he was married. He felt a stab of regret, wishing he had not made the bracelet. Then a wave of self-reproach for the regret. He shook his head. This was not the time for his old doubts. He felt that he could forgive anything to anyone, because happiness was the greatest agent of purification. He felt certain that every living being wished him well tonight. He wanted to meet someone, to face the first stranger, to stand, disarmed and open, and to say, "Look at me." People, he thought, were as hungry for a sight of joy as he had always been, for a moment's relief from that gray load of suffering, which seemed so inexplicable and unnecessary. He had never been able to understand why men should be unhappy. The dark road had risen imperceptibly to the top of a hill. He stopped and turned. The red glow was a narrow strip far to the west. Above it, small, at a distance of miles, the words of a neon sign stood written on the blackness of the sky. Reardon Steele. He stood straight, as if before a bench of judgment. He thought that in the darkness of this night other signs were lighted over the country. Reardon Ore, Reardon Coal, Reardon Limestone. He thought of the days behind him. He wished it were possible to light a neon sign above them, saying, "Reardon Life." He turned sharply and walked on. As the road came closer to his house, he noticed that his steps were slowing down and that something was ebbing away from his mood. He felt a dim reluctance to enter his home, which he did not want to feel. No, he thought, not tonight. They'll understand it tonight. But he did not know, he had never defined, what it was that he wanted them to understand. He saw lights in the windows of the living room when he approached his house. The house stood on a hill, rising before him like a big white bulk. It looked naked, with a few semi-colonial pillars for reluctant ornament. It had the cheerless look of a nudity not worth revealing. He was not certain whether his wife noticed him when he entered the living room. She sat by the fireplace, talking, the curve of her arm floating in graceful emphasis of her words. He heard a small break in her voice, and thought that she had seen him, but she did not look up, and her sentence went on smoothly. He could not be certain. "But it's just that a man of culture is bored with the alleged wonders of purely material ingenuity," she was saying. "He simply refuses to get excited about plumbing." Then she turned her head, looked at Reardon in the shadows across the long room, and her arms spread gracefully, like two swan necks by her sides. "Why, darling," she said in a bright tone of amusement, "isn't it too early to come home? Wasn't there some slag to sweep or tuyere to polish?" They all turned to him. His mother, his brother Philip, and Paul Larkin, their old friend. "I'm sorry," he answered. "I know I'm late." "Don't say you're sorry," said his mother. "You could have telephoned." He looked at her, trying vaguely to remember something. "You promised to be here for dinner tonight." "Oh, that's right, I did. I'm sorry. But today at the mills, we poured..." He stopped. He did not know what made him unable to utter the one thing he had come home to say. He added only, "It's just that I forgot." "That's what Mother means," said Philip. "Oh, let him get his bearings. He's not quite here yet. He's still at the mills," his wife said gaily. "Do take your coat off, Henry." Paul Larkin was looking at him with the devoted eyes of an inhibited dog. "Hello, Paul," said Reardon. "When did you get in?" "Oh, I just hopped down on the 5:35 from New York." Larkin was smiling in gratitude for the attention. "Trouble? Who hasn't got trouble these days?" Larkin's smile became resigned, to indicate that the remark was merely philosophical. "But no special trouble this time. I just thought I'd drop in to see you." His wife laughed. "You've disappointed him, Paul." She turned to Reardon. "Is it an inferiority complex or a superiority one, Henry? Do you believe that nobody can want to see you just for your own sake? Or do you believe that nobody can get along without your help?" He wanted to utter an angry denial, but she was smiling at him as if this were merely a conversational joke, and he had no capacity for the sort of conversations which were not supposed to be meant, so he did not answer. He stood looking at her, wondering about the things he had never been able to understand. Lillian Reardon was generally regarded as a beautiful woman. She had a tall, graceful body, the kind that looked well in high-waisted gowns of the Empire style, which she made it a practice to wear. Her exquisite profile belonged to a cameo of the same period. Its pure, proud lines and the lustrous, light brown waves of her hair, worn with classical simplicity, suggested an austere, imperial beauty. But when she turned full face, people experienced a small shock of disappointment. Her face was not beautiful. The eyes were the flaw. They were vaguely pale, neither quite gray nor brown, lifelessly empty of expression. Reardon had always wondered, since she seemed amused so often, why there was no gaiety in her face.